floor is open if anyone has anything to say about the meditation. Or any other questions or comments are fine.
Namaste. Thank you for this heart-opening meditation. I hesitated to raise my hand because I'm hesitating to even to try to put into words I for the first time today I feel I've finally silenced the mind, and this sense of truly offering the heart to the beloved was deeply felt. I don't know how else to explain it other than in these words that are very can't quite accurately express what was felt. So thank you.
That's the most accurate expression. It can't be expressed accurately because it's always more. And it's only divine love that creates silence in the mind. Nothing else will do it. The chatter will continue until it's overwhelmed by love. It's only the heart that can overrule the ego mind when the heart is connected to the source of our being. And that brings liberation. So now you have the secret. Thank you. You were so first, Priya.
I also wanted to say thank you. I really appreciated the meditation. And I've actually been practicing that already today because I had a very angry ego this morning. So that was kind of the only practice that kind of got away from that feeling of bad, of being like angry and disappointed and just kind of frustrated and demanding and like all these voices that were appearing in the mind, but then that kind of slowly during the day faded off, and during the meditation I still feel like my whole mind is kind of expanding and like softening, and there wasn't any, sometimes I feel like there's a defensiveness when you speak about or encouraging to send love to the to the deeper real self, but there was just like a heart melting, I felt.
Wonderful.
So it was beautiful. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Priyaji. Because you are beloved, that's why you have that name, and the beloved is always sending love to the beloved. And so it's very easy to connect because it's yourself you're connecting with, and it's only our self-alienation into a false identity and a program that was created in childhood that brings us into a trance in which that connection feels like it's been cut. And then we are lost in the maya of that bad feeling. But as soon as you connect, you can heal it because it's true and it's real and the other is false. So I'm glad that you reconnected, and now it's important to stay connected and never let that current of energy ever be cut. Okay?
And actually, I had a question coming up, because this morning I was listening to your encouragement from the other night, where just like stay in bliss and don't worry and don't try to figure things out. And then all these questions come up, like how do we just override all the fragmentations and don't heal all the things that, like between the feminine and masculine and all the other fragments and things in the mind, and just feel that love. And tonight it kind of feels obvious, like, although it was so easy. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand necessarily how the switch came. Like, I guess from the ego mind is impossible. But what is that? Can you speak about that switch from not believing in it being possible, and then suddenly it's just happening?
Well, yes. The ego is a defense against love. So its thoughts will want to make you believe it's impossible, so that you don't open your heart to the self and receive healing and salvation. But because it's a false identity, it's very easy to break through, and your soul will then return to its natural state, which is love of God. And that love will then wash out the ego's delusions and antagonism to love. The ego has a hatred of love because it has been hurt by toxic forms of love, because people use the word but without the feeling. And so when you have been deceived by people claiming to love you but acting in a way that isn't loving, then your ego becomes cynical and says, never again, I won't believe in love, I won't connect, I won't become vulnerable. And so it creates these defenses. But you know that all that it does is strangle you and keep you in a state of self alienation and of torment. And so the soul is always ready to help break through when there is the healthy part of the ego realizes it has to become free of this burden and this negative demonic energy of anger or hatred, and then it will, the love of God will break through and bring grace. So it's very easy for God, who is almighty, to shift you out of your ego if there is a yearning for that. So always keep the heart open to that yearning for oneness with the beloved until it's fully attained. Oh, your turn, Lakshmi.
I also enjoyed this meditation and was very, I don't know, surprised, but delighted, I would say, to see how just the connection to love opens the heart almost automatically, right? If one truly yearns for that opening to happen. But I wanted to share that the part of the meditation that was the most intense for me and that took me to a whole other level is when you said, I want to finish with the first one you said, because that's the one that started, but love is ultimate power, ultimate wisdom. Each one of them, like when I focused on each one of them, it was so intense. But I want to finish with the last one, which was the first one. Because that was the one that just jettisoned me into a whole other level, if you wish. And it's when you said, love is the ultimate freedom. And I had never thought of love as the ultimate freedom. You know, you think of love as, you know, this and that, even wisdom, okay? You've always said the soul is pure intelligence. It's love and intelligence, chapter 4, 5, and then obviously the light. But had never thought of love as the ultimate freedom. And I can't explain it, but I felt it in the heart. In such a sublime way, you know, I would say it's a vibration, but it's also a delight, and that's why I use the word delight. It's a joy, it's just, it's an expansion, it's a, what's the other word I want to say? It's, yeah, it's like an explosion
Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's what I felt. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you why the association of love and freedom creates mm-hmm. or created, at least in myself, this...
Sure.
This it's almost like a portal that was opened, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I don't know if that is the freedom of liberation when one is completely free of all the attachments, identifications, or what happened, or what does freedom mean in this case, ultimate freedom?
Well, the ego is a cage. It's a prison in which consciousness is held down in a state in which it is separated from its beloved. And the ego creates an antagonism to love. So it creates an energy field in which your consciousness feels like you can't love, either because people aren't lovable, because the ego has judgments and projections on them, and the world is awful, and how can I love it, and I'm angry at God. And the ego will produce all kinds of negativity about love. And how can I love myself when I have done all these horrible things, or I am so this or that, right? The ego is filled with self-hatred. So that prison of negative thoughts is the hell realm that the ego is. It's just made of those thoughts and beliefs and attitudes that are antagonistic to love. And so when you feel the truth of what love is and the power of love and the joy of love, you break free of the ego, literally. And then the love carries you all the way to the oneness with God, because love is oneness, and God is the source of love. So there's an automatic rising into that state of freedom that is ultimate freedom. But it's also freedom on the phenomenal plane, because when you're in a state of love, you're not worried about things, right? You're not in a state of mental rumination and chatter and concern and all of that. Everything is beautiful, right? So, and the mind can be in the present, and love is presence also. And so there's freedom, because the ego is never present. It's always in the past or the future, worried about both, and never able to bring you to stillness. I mean, it keeps you from being in stillness. But love is that state in which you transcend time, and it is the portal to eternity and to the real. So yes, it's ultimate freedom immediately. Okay, but the love has to be total. It can't be an egoic form of love. It has to be love in which the ego's delusion is refuted, is undone, it disappears. It's gone. There is no ego, because all the ego is lies about love. And those lies, once you see through them, they disappear. They cannot remain in your consciousness. So there's no prison to go back to. You know, it's interesting, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there were two philosophers, one living in France, Michel Foucault, and another living in Czechoslovakia. His name was Jan Patočka. And not many people know about Patočka's writings, and I don't think, because it was wasn't the Czech Republic. Czechoslovakia was behind the Iron Curtain at that time, and it was very stringent police state condition in which the thought of the West was not allowed to be published in that country. And it was the Soviet secret police had a very powerful oppressive presence throughout the society. And he was one of those dissident philosophers who led a movement of social liberation from this oppression. And but he was a very serious philosopher, and he wrote a number of books focusing on a history, or even what both he and Foucault called an archaeology of the development of consciousness from the time of ancient Greece to the present. They focused on the West only, not on the East. And both of them came up with parallel ideas. I don't think either of them knew of each other's writings. But they came up with this powerful understanding that the ancient Greek philosophy that was the leading principle that organized culture, that organized the meaning of life. What is the purpose of life for someone who is brought up in one of the in Athens, let's say, in one of the Greek city states? And what was the main focus of education? And it was the care of the soul. That's what life was about for the Greeks, that you would learn to care for your soul and all of what that meant, okay? And both of these writers went very deeply into what is care of the soul. And it was only because both Judaism and Christianity were Hellenized, to use the academic term. They were both infiltrated by Greek philosophy, that the jealous God aspect that we talked about the other day, and the oppressive militarization of the religious orders, was softened by the Greek idea that to care for the soul is to develop our capacity for divine love, and to use the wisdom of the heart to overcome aggression and paranoia and greed and attachment, and to be able to live in accord with the Ten Commandments, et cetera, et cetera. So, and the same happened to Islam. So that by the time of the Middle Ages, if you were to read the leading philosophers of any of those three religions, whether you read Maimonides, for example, or Aquinas, or Avicenna, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. They were all speaking about the care of the soul, and that this was the main activity of a religious life. And it was the loss of this core feeling that this is what life is about that caused the decline, the lack of belief in that there is a soul, and the whole question of care of the ego is a very different matter, because what the ego wants is power, and it wants all the satisfaction of its jouissance, it wants security, it wants all a very different kind of life, and a purpose of living. For profit and gain and power and all of the things that capitalism represents, that movement shifted human consciousness away from what had been our core concern for centuries. And both of them came to this same conclusion, and their books are extraordinarily synchronicitously parallel. So I found that to be very interesting when I discovered that. Patočka was ultimately, he led a movement for liberation in Czechoslovakia, which led to the Prague Spring that brought Václav Havel into power, and there was this temporary time when it was a very beautiful Renaissance. It didn't last very long, but it was a beautiful period not that long ago, and I'm sure some of you remember. And he was responsible largely for that. He died after a very torturous interrogation by the secret police, and so they eliminated him. But his work continued to have a very powerful effect, and it it inspired the Czechs to rise up and free themselves from that oppressive yoke. So the power of love, even in the modern day, when it's expressed with wisdom, with reason, with understanding, still has the capacity to inspire and to, let's say, influence the morphogenic field of a whole nation and even of a world. So it's something that we must never be cynical about, the power of love to bring about transformation in world conditions. The problem is there's a love shortage in the world, and because the ego is anti-love, it has joined the enemy, and it has lost, the soul has become imprisoned within that negative casing that is the cause of the demise of our world. So it's only love that will free all of us from the prison that the ego has become. Okay, I'm not sure why that came to mind, but it did. Anyone else want to? Or is she?
Just in response to that, because that was really interesting, do they write about or recommend like particular practices to care for the soul?
Oh, yes. Well, Foucault wrote a lot about that, what the Greeks and the Romans practices were. And so, yes, there's a lot of that. But, of course, meditation is one of the main practices. But also karma yoga, you know, and treating the other lovingly and... A lot of it is resonant with 12-step programs of making amends if there are, you know, schisms with other people and creating a life in which that energy field of love creates a mutual appreciation community, right? So the whole idea of love is that it wants to be shared, and it's only the power of love that can create a community. You can't do it with any other organizational principle. If you try to use the sword as one, you will end up with not a community, but with a gang, maybe a mafia, but not a true community. So it's the care of the soul was also the care of the community.
Thank you. And one more question, that's really helpful. But
you can read the books, by the way, of Foucault and of Patochka. Two of his books that are very important, one is called Plato and Europe, and the other is called Heretical Essays, that go into those subjects very deeply.
You often say, and you said the other day, this is probably a really silly question, but the ego has kept the soul captive. Why isn't the soul stronger than the ego? Like, I understand all the programming and everything, but I would imagine a soul would be stronger than an ego. And this ego is not real.
The soul, in the latter days, has lost its energy because it gradually lost that connection to God. It lost the love over many lifetimes and became more externally focused. So that in these final lifetimes, the soul is asleep. It's identified with the ego. It doesn't know itself. It thinks it is the ego. And that's why it's so difficult. When you ask the question, who am I? You don't get, I am a soul. You get, I'm this person who was born in this year, and I have these parents, and I have these, you know, this religion, and this, all of these things I inherited, and I speak this mother tongue, and I write all of the identifications of the body. You don't get, I am the soul that was born into that body, but I am not that body or that ego. So that's what you have to get to awaken the soul to its true nature. And then the love opens, and then victory is easy. in.
Thank you, Shunya. I notice that I'm feeling this immense difficulty with opening the heart and really letting love through. And you've spoken about already the resistance of the ego and the antagonism against love and the difficulty with trust and not being deceived and all of these things that I guess it has to do with. And it's curious because there are moments where I am able to let it through, but then after some time it closes up again. Mm-hmm. What I'm feeling now is that there's just this huge blockage, this immense weight of resistance. Underneath it, there are every now and then currents of love that want to come through, but every time I feel a little bit of it, it gets blocked again. Mm-hmm. There's a fear that almost immediately comes and stops
it. Fear of what? Tell me exactly. What's the resistance based on? What's the idea that it fears if you let yourself love?
That I'll, that I'll let go of something and I'll be...
What? What will you let go?
My defenses.
Defense against what?
Against, I don't know, being myself.
Let me postulate that when you were a very young child, your anger and hatred of your parents kept you with a sense that of your own ability to survive. You needed to be different from them. You needed to get the power of hatred and anger to survive the terrible, traumatic blow of their loss, of the loss of their love and of the loss of their recognition of you and of the sense of your being a being of great beauty and dignity and worth because you weren't receiving it in their eyes. And so it was only by holding on to non-love of them that you could keep their projections on you from overwhelming you and destroying you.
That's very deep.
But right now, that's no longer the case, you see. So you're defending against an enemy that doesn't exist any longer. And you're living in the past. That knot is from a very old time. And now all it does is keep you in this prison in which you can't grow to your full extent. And the love that you resisted then was the love of the parents, not the love of God. Your soul hadn't awakened to that option even, and the reality of God, which is partly also of how you were not raised properly with a spiritual understanding. You were cheated of that. But the soul now has the power to love God without it becoming vulnerable or exploited by people. It's not about, I'm now going to be a doormat and everybody will walk over me because, you know, I don't have defenses against, you know, that's a kind of ridiculous idea. It's simply that you love your real self, which gives you power, it gives you dignity, it gives you worth because you're an eternal being. And you can walk tall and feel proud in a spiritual way, not an egoic way, that you're a child of God. And as a son of God, you have the right to be here with that full authorization of being able to receive God's wisdom and God's power and God's freedom and God's ability to emanate love, which is what creates a kingdom of heaven that enables you then to have happiness in your life. And why cheat yourself of happiness? This knot is your enemy. It's not your friend. It's not your defense. It's an offense now against you.
Well, that's very useful. And I appreciate everything you just said a lot. And it already helps in a sense with letting it go, but that's what I'm experiencing as well, is I can hear these things and believe it more and more, But there's still such a,
you're identified with the knot.
Mm-hmm.
And so letting go of the knot is ego death. So the ego wants to stay alive. It doesn't want to die because it felt it would die from lack of love before. That's why it created the knot. And so now the knot doesn't want to let go. You know, you've spent your whole life building that knot up and making it strong. You're proud of that knot. That became your fortress. And so now to open the gates is to feel, from the perspective of the knot, of I'm just going to defeat myself and let the enemy come in. No, I can't do that, right? But the enemy is love. The enemy is your real self. And so you're defeating yourself by holding on to the knot. But the knot itself is not capable of knowing that. So you have to realize you are not the knot. And that's the only way you can untie the knot.
And would encouraging love to come up, is that a useful practice as well? Just trying to keep focusing on that feeling even if it gets suppressed?
Sure.
Constantly?
Sure. Make it love of the real self. Okay? Don't worry about trying to love others, because then it'll say, oh no, I can't trust and I'll be deceived and right, I'll be taken advantage of. But you can't, God's not going to take advantage of your love. You're just going to gain more wisdom and power and joy. So what is there to fight against? Right?
Seems only like an advantage to me, really.
Yes, of course. So, and this is what will give you the power to really be free to express your creative intelligence fully, because that's locked up in the knot. And you have tremendous potential as a philosopher and as a being of wisdom, as a teacher, as a healer. But it can't come out as long as that knot is there. So why hold yourself back?
I'll reflect on that.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much, Shunya.
Is there anyone else? Ah, okay, Anandi, blissful one.
I have a question regarding processing. What exactly, who exactly is processing? It's the soul processing, or the ego, or the soul tries to process, and the ego is like the holding against or trying to avoiding it, and on which level it is happening, the processing. It like there's different levels, like intellectual understanding, and then also if there has it to be lived in on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say how many levels? Let's say from my past there was a lot of insights about family system, so it feels like once everything, the cards lay open, right? Are there different levels? What else has to be processed?
Well, okay. What does the processing in a true sense is the buddhi, okay? The intellect. We have buddhi, manas, ahankar, right? Neither of the manas or the ahankar can process. They are the problem. Negative thoughts, negative emotions, negative feelings of attitudes, etc. So the intellect is like the linchpin. The intellect belongs to the ego, but it also belongs to the soul. And the processing is the awakening of the buddhi to the realization that it's not the ego. And the ego's perspectives on reality were acquired in a traumatic childhood environment, in which one had to defend oneself against non-loving powers that be or that were, right? And situations of adversity and misunderstanding and powerlessness, etc. So the decisions that were made and the beliefs that were established in childhood have to now be looked at by an intelligence that is adult and that is not a child, that is not identified with that that feeling of a desperate need to defend oneself against adverse others who would take advantage of one, right? That perspective of the ego, one can see now is self-defeating. Because in reality, what you project is what you'll get back. So the more joy you put out, the more you'll get back from the world. The more love you put out, the more love will come back to you. And really, the intellect will realize, yeah, love is actually a more important and useful tool, power, feeling, however you want to call it, than anger, hatred, fear, or any of the other egoic emotions or defenses. And so your intellect will weigh them and say, okay, this no longer serves me, and it's self-defeating, so why not eliminate it? But that intellect first thinks it belongs to the ego, but once it begins to process, it realizes, well, wait a minute, consciousness existed before the ego was formed, because a consciousness must have come into the body, right? The fetus became conscious, a soul came in. Well, that's what I must be. And that soul has a very different environment than the mere local environment of the ego and the body. And because the soul is bodiless, it doesn't have to hold on to the ego's perspective of I have to protect my body against pain and death and all of those things, worries that the ego has. And the soul has the luxury of being able to free itself of that level of concern, so that it becomes concerned much more about your ultimate destiny. Where is your soul going to go when the body dies? Where are you going to go at the end of the cycle? Do you want to reach the highest state? And would you like to be free of the burdens of karma? Would you like to be free of suffering? The intellect can figure out that the only way to do that is to be in resonance with God consciousness, not with ego consciousness. And so then there'll be a gradual shift and rising into the higher chakras. And each chakra level brings more power, more wisdom, more light, more mastery, more willpower, more of the power of freedom that will finally break through and destroy the ego's grip, and eventually it disappears entirely. So it's the buddhi that awakens and brings you back to the chit, the sat-chit ananda of God.
Thank you. So what I understand, it's the buddhi, the intellect, so it can be processed on an intellectual level. It doesn't have to be felt again, all the traumas, like on an emotional level.
Well, thought and emotion are connected. It's the ego that disconnects them. That's one of the problems, is our capacity. Our mind and our heart got split and separated by the sensor that repressed the emotions because they were unbearable. So what the main job of the buddhi is to reunite the mind and the heart. And the buddhi can do it, because those feelings are not unbearable to the soul. They're unbearable to the ego, but not to the soul. And the soul sublimates those negative feelings, no matter, even if it's murderous hatred, fury, it turns it into the power of defeating Maya. It turns every vice into a virtue. And it uses it in the journey to liberation. So actually, the more hatred and the more anger you have, the more power you have to liberate yourself instantly. People who had too healthy an upbringing, really, they don't have a chance for liberation, because they don't have enough of that energy of fuel, a rocket fuel of anger and hatred. You got to have that. But it has to be hatred of the ego itself, because you were harmed by egos. And so you don't want to be like what you were your enemies. You want to be free of that. And so it is that realization that you have chosen the wrong method to try to protect yourself, and that all you have done is bury yourself underground in a a kind of bunker to try to protect yourself against incoming attacks, but all you've done is destroy your own freedom. And so now when you use your intelligence to break free, what you're breaking free out of the bunker is your heart. And the deeper feelings underneath the murderous rage is the infinite love. And the love heals the rage and turns it into the power of liberation. You're very welcome. By the way, I don't think I mentioned that the phrase that that both Foucault and Patochka came up with, that was the heart of this idea of care for the soul, it is the state of self-forgetting love. This is what Plato used. Self meaning, of course, ego self, the little self. When you're in a state of love, that love has to be so total that you forget your ego. You're just in a trance of love. And it's that state that when you sustain it for a period of time, the ego literally dissolves. And all that remains is the infinite self that is love. Plato was very wise. And it was that, the Greek wisdom, that created Europe. That was the source of all of the cultural energy that created the Renaissance and that produced a European culture that lasted until they forgot to take care of the soul. And now we're in a post-European world. Europe used to be the rulers of the world. And then they, in the 20th century, they got exhausted with two world wars against themselves, right? Internal European conflict. They lost the care of the soul. Then the U.S. took over and had its half a century of power. And now we're in a post-U.S. world, because the U.S., they don't care for the soul. They were interested in fun, Disneyland and all of that, and superficial jouissances, but there was no deep cultural care for the soul in the American so-called civilization, because it was built on the genocide of the native peoples. It was built on power itself, on the desire for mastery and conquest, not on care of the soul. And so it could not sustain itself very long. But now we're in the time of the post-Anglo, some would say Anglo-Zionist European domination of the world, and the rising powers of Russia and China, who have very different civilizational modalities, are a threat that they can't tolerate. And rather than simply gracefully offering to share the power, they are in a struggle to the death. And that is the death of the planet itself. And now we're very close to the first nukes going off in Ukraine. And once the first dirty bomb is exploded, the escalation will be exponential and very rapid, and lead to a wildfire of global war. And it will be on three fronts: against Russia, against China, against Iran, because those are the three powers that are challenging the hegemony of the imperialist powers of the 20th century. And to hold on, even though their cultures and their countries are bankrupt, they refuse to give in and are using technological means to enslave their own people and minimize their population so it can't rise up against their own rulers. And they are making one last-ditch effort to sustain their power over the world. But it has to fail. But it will take the whole world down with them, because they don't have care for the soul. They don't have love. They don't have a communion with that real power that can share the political power and doesn't need to dominate and is not afraid of humility and of death. And it's only when that fearlessness comes through care of the soul that a culture can be created that cannot be dominated. Okay, that's my political rant for the evening. Mm-hmm. Marjiva, you have a mic.
I wanted to ask you a question about the power, let's say, to shift from ego to soul. And you described very beautifully my last dream I remembered, in which there's just that same scene of the ego, you know, who comes in to knife the soul, and the, you know, the war of the psyche, as you described the other night. And so it was the internalized oppressor, in as I know it from, as I understand it from my past, what the structure of the ego itself internalized the oppressor. So there's this oppressor that I felt really is the one that I feel this pain in my chest. It's as if, you know, it's that knife coming through. So it got internalized. It's not acting it out and trying to get it out of me, which was the Kali strategy. You know, then I have to, since then, I've been feeling it within. It had to be felt within. So it's a very interesting phenomena, how the projections work to not have to deal with this internalized force within one. So this project that I can speak of for myself, of I don't know, somehow having that willpower to not project it, to keep it contained, and then having to face it within, and now transforming it, what is there, that hate, that back into love again, because that's what it was originally to begin with. Okay. That has been, you know, years now of this challenge, of little by little, you know, getting there. And in this particular dream, what was very interesting was there was the moment in which the representative of the soul could flee, you know, try to flee this attack, the fight or flight mode. But there was the moment in which I became lucid in the dream, and in that place of lucidity, I could make the choice. I could make a choice of which the ego didn't have, because it was going to flee, or the soul that was taken over by the ego couldn't do. But I could make that choice, and the choice was very, the intellect knew that the love, it was love. It was love that would tame the beast, literally. And it was a very simple dream, very beautifully, and no words, just the images. And when I woke up to the lucid dreamer, it was, I've been feeling the effects of it, but also that shift of where the choice really comes in. I've seen it building up, but that full choice that I saw in the dream, in which the mad knifer, like the Mad Hatter, you know, was you know, facing the asuras and the devas at war. But there he was, and then, you know, for a comic relief, the oppressor sat down and the soul served it a glass of white, pure milk, and they lived happily ever after. I don't know, they didn't say the story, but that was the energy of the entire dream. You know, the enemy became the friend, and there was just a transformation that happened. But it happened, it could happen in that lucidity of the dreamer.
Well, that's it. That's it. Exactly. So now you have to be lucid while awake, which is much harder. But if you become lucid when you're awake, you realize you are not that body. You were never born, and that whole mad knifer never doesn't really exist. It was an internalization, and then became a defense, but a self-hating defense. That then had to project hating and anger and control of the other and using the knife on the other so you wouldn't be the victim of it. But all of that was within a dream state because the ego is a dream. It's not awake. And so as you remain lucid, by observing the ego in its tendencies, even if there are very minor tendencies to still react with aggression or anger or some kind of judgment, you can give it a glass of milk and soothe its anger and its fear and create a friendship with that higher power that you are, so that it realizes it's not in danger anymore and it's not being mistreated and it doesn't have to act out or act in aggression toward itself or the other. And there is no other. We are all sharing the same glass of milk. You know, we're all in the ocean of milk together. And there is only that one power of love that is the essential nature of every being. And once you are lucid in that, then that, because it's more coherent and more powerful than the knife, that radiance will shine and dissolve whatever remains of the egoic shell.
So that level of consciousness that's lucid in the dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Ekavada Jada?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Because in their first teaching...
Ekajivavada.
Ekajivavada, yeah. The inaugural teaching you gave, I just felt it was all the vadas, how you go from the ego, you know, the drishti, you know, how they get convoluted, and then etc. then to the ajatavada. And so it's the signs, you know, are very clear. Or at least they're getting ever more clear as to what this processing ultimately is.
Yes.
So what I got it from the dream and what I think you're saying is that only at that level of the lucid dreamer can we really redream one's own world and the underworld.
Yes, yes, because this is the same kind of dream. It's really not different. The fact that you got that dream, to me, that's a herald dream. It's a precognitive dream. It says what happens in the dream will now happen when awake. So that lucidity will stay with you as your state. That's the Turiya state, right? When you are lucid while awake. And then you'll be lucid also in the dream and in deep sleep. And deep sleep will just be returning to the light. The consciousness, that background radiance of the presence of that pure, infinite love is what is the underlying energy that creates the dream. And so the dream itself will shift now that love is free to produce very different kinds of scenarios than anger could do. So there will be a morphing of the field and the phenomenal realm as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have 1 minute left. Anyone with a burning question or comment? Okay. Was this a useful discussion for people? How many people are on the side of love? Yeah? Is there anyone who's against love? Would you admit it if you were?
Does it count to fragments that are against love?
Do you?
Yeah.
You do.
I'm kind of resonating with the answer you give to Ken.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, most people have a fragment or two that is still anti-love. But if you stay in the state of love, those fragments will dissolve. So I hope you choose to be in that love of the Supreme Self and let the fragments all disappear. So I hope that everyone will do that, because that's our mission. That's our only hope for liberation. And our only empowerment and our only way of serving the world, because that's what the world is missing. And if we can offer that, then we have a priceless value to share. Namaste.
Namaste.